When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest Mansplaining Maryland edition. It's Wednesday, October 12th, 2022. On today's show, Blonde is a heavily fictionalized biopic. I mean, so much so, biopic's probably the wrong word. We'll get into it. It's about Marilyn Monroe. And it comes from the writer and director, Andrew Dominik. And it's adapted from a novel by Joyce Carol Oates. And then Hulu has a new half-hour sitcom. It's about a half-hour sitcom on Hulu. It stars Rachel Bloom, Keegan-Michael Key, Paul Reiser, and it's from the creator of Modern Family. And finally, one of the real legends of Nashville has died. We discuss Loretta Lynn with Slate's own Carl Wilson. Joining me today is Julia Turner, the deputy managing editor of the LA Times. Hey, Julia.
Hello.
And of course, Dana Stevens is the film critic of Slate.com and the author of a beautifully rendered extended biographical essay in the form of a book about Buster Keaton entitled Cameraman. Dana, you're out on the road for that, yeah?
Yeah, and not at this moment, but I wanted to just say a quick word to some of the listeners who wrote in asking about how I have upcoming book tour dates in Seattle and the Bay Area and California. Indeed, I do. And to anybody who's written in, I will get back to you with all of the info. You have not missed those dates. They're in November and December. I also wanted to mention, and I'm so sorry to use this place for a plug, but I also have a thing, a really cool thing, a two-day Keaton Festival coming up in Kansas City, Missouri. So if you live in Kansas City, Missouri, or the Bay Area, or Seattle, you can write into culturefest@slate.com, and I'll give you all the details on those appearances.
Excellent. Yeah, people should go. I had so much fun at the one cameraman event I attended and co-hosted with Isaac Butler. That was really, really cool. So if these are anything like that, I can't encourage people enough to go. It'll be so fun.
Yeah, I don't know if it's 2 years of COVID or what, but I have been loving these book events. Like at every single one, I meet people with incredible stories and we have great conversations and we have drinks at a bar afterwards. Like seriously, please come out if you're in any of those three cities. I would love to meet you.
All right. Shall we make a show?
Let us do so.
All right, please. Blonde, it's a new movie from writer-director Andrew Dominik. As I said, it's based on a Joyce Carol Oates novel from about 20 years ago. It's a fictionalization of Marilyn Monroe's, obviously, one barely needs to even say it anymore, tragic life. This is a very kaleidoscopic film, not at all a biopic, but a fragmented meditation on, as the film really argues throughout, the whopping discrepancy that opened up between Norma Jean Baker, a little girl orphaned by an absconded baby daddy, and her institutionalized mother. And that person, Norma's inner life, is filled with all kinds of torment and doubt and self-doubt. And by the way, all of the great literature she's read, she's repeatedly thinking about Dostoevsky and Chekhov. And Marilyn, the dumb blonde and greatest Hollywood sex icon of all time, this fabrication that I think she hated having been turned into. The film stars Ana de Armas in the title role, Bobby Cannavale as Joe DiMaggio, and Adrian Brody as Arthur Miller, both of whom were her husbands at one point or another. All right, in the clip we're about to hear, Bobby Cannavale plays... I had said Joe DiMaggio. What I should have said is that the film is very coy about this. He's credited as ex-athlete, so a character very strongly based on Joe DiMaggio, who ended up married to Marilyn Monroe. They're on their first date in what we're about to hear. Let's have a listen.
Anyway, you don't seem retired. You're in the papers so much.
Not half as much as you, Marilyn.
Who, me? Well, that's just studio publicity. Oh, they're awful. The things they make up. I know you're supposed to get used to it. But I just can't. It really hurts.
All right, Dana. Well, Oates had made great pains to make totally plain to readers at the front of her novel that the novel was a novel. It was a work of fiction, you know, the way like Libra is about the Oswald assassination of Kennedy by DeLillo. I mean, there's just a lot of precedent for books that draw heavily, heavily upon primary and secondary historical sources, but then confect them into something really seriously fictionalized. Doesn't this run up a little bit in this film against the expectation of biopics that we're seeing the true story behind the legend? It's a peek behind the scenes. How did it work for you to have this story, which is already very familiar, retold in ways that at times hit the familiar beats, but at other times was so distinctly a work of imagination?
I mean, I guess it's a fine hair to split, but I would start off by saying that that's not what I object to in this movie. There's a lot about this movie that I strongly dislike, and hearing that clip just reminded me again of how annoyed I was at nearly every one of the 2 hours and 48 minutes or whatever it is that this movie lasts. But it wasn't about the divergence of the story on screen from Marilyn Monroe's real life. And it doesn't really have to do, I don't think, with the idea of fictionalizing a biography that we all know, you know, the main beats of. And I have not read the Joyce Carol Oates novel. So all of that said, the things about this movie that made me, I think, during the viewing of it, just irritated, and then later on remembering the movie kind of angry, have more to do with the movie's tonality, its emotional tone, which is extremely unvarying. And in my review of the movie, I call it miserabilist. You know, I think that Andrew Dominik is determined, and he said this in interviews since, that he's determined to make the viewer feel bad. You know, I think he said in one much quoted interview that he thinks that the viewer should be howling like a rhesus monkey when they exit the movie.
Left out in the snow.
Yeah, I forgot. Yes, howling like a rhesus monkey left out in the snow. That actually sounds like a more interesting mood than the one that I exited Blonde in. But yeah, it's one of those movies that wants to just bludgeon the viewer with the awfulness of the subjective experience of this character. So, and I am not the first film critic to have said this about the movie, what I feel like this movie ends up doing is taking the performance of Ana de Armas, which I'm curious to hear if you guys agree with me, but I think is sort of amazing to the degree a performance can be amazing when it is of a very poorly written and narrowly imagined character, and kind of imprisons it in this awful narrative space where Marilyn doesn't get anything to do except suffer. And if you think about why Marilyn Monroe's movies have lasted, right? I mean, why she has remained such an enduring icon, it's not because she was sexy and suffering. I mean, that is certainly a part of her myth, but it's because she was fun to watch on screen. Fun being the key word. She had a sense of humor. She had a sense of wit about her own sexuality and her own objectification. But the movie is not interested in her as an artist or as a worker, just a creator of work, or certainly as a person who ever had fun or enjoyed herself or desired anything. It's only interested in her as an object of other people's desire and exploitation. And granted, I mean, the movie is sympathetic to her, right? I actually don't agree with people who think that this movie is sadistic and kind of enjoying her exploitation exactly. And I think that Dominik's intent is to make this sort of feminist document about, look how, you know, society has torn this poor woman apart. But in doing so, I just feel like it betrays a much more important thing than the biographical facts. It betrays the spirit of a person who, you know, wanted to do more than she was able to do in the constrictions of the industry, and, you know, who made some really interesting work. And I mean, as an example of that, I will point to this moment midway through the movie or so where it suddenly switches to black and white, as this movie randomly does at certain moments for no apparent narrative reason. And we're in an actor's studio class with Marilyn Monroe and some other acting students. And Arthur Miller's, or the character called, I guess he's called the playwright, who's based on Arthur Miller, is observing the class, right? And the idea is that everyone has very low expectations of this dumb blonde movie star, and that she then wows them all with her delivery of a monologue from one of Miller's plays. But Andrew Dominik, the director, chooses to fast forward, like literally you leave out in an ellipsis whatever she did during the delivery of the speech that made everyone so gaga over her delivery. And it's just a very, very strange choice. Like, the point of the scene is to show us that she's better at delivering the speech than anyone expected, but we ourselves, the audience, don't get to see it happen. We just get to see the reaction. There's a lot of moments like that where it's almost like her agency is being taken away by Andrew Dominik. So end of rant. I've been talking for too long already, but I felt that this movie did this over and over and over again, and it was endless and boring. And by the time I left, I was mad.
Julia, endless and boring and maddening. Where do you fall on this?
I'm such a creature of expectations, and we had heard so much about how terrible this film was, but thought it would be interesting to discuss Marilyn as a figure and this film's treatment of her anyway, that I went in bracing for sadism and worthlessness. And probably because of that, I actually found myself admiring a lot about what the film sets out to do, or at least maybe that's the opposite of what I admired. I'm not sure I admire what the film sets out to do. I admire a lot of what the film ends up doing, in that I think Ana de Armas's performance is really, really incredible. And it sort of conjures, I think, the feeling that I've had watching Marilyn Monroe movies, which is just that she seems like this kind of vibrating, special, odd marvel to look at and behold, and in kind of her beauty and her energy and her magnetism. So that was super compelling. And then I think the most generous possible interpretation of the film is that it's most interested in how disorienting fame is, and being the object of so much fascination, lust, desire, sexism, dismissal. And so the film gets kind of less and less cogent as it goes along, and she gets more and more disoriented and disassociated, and there's sort of less and less of a self. It seems to posit like fame ruined her. Eventually there was nothing left inside. And that's sort of formally interesting. And it uses all kinds of interesting filmmaking tools to try to do that. And fame does seem really bad and complicated. I don't know. I sort of thought that was interesting. But in the end, I did feel that it got further and further away from what was most interesting in her. And I think the criticism is it was never interesting in what was in her. But I think you do at the beginning see a little bits of her, you know, negotiating her salary or moving to New York or comparing Arthur Miller's plays to Chekhov in ways that make him insecure. And then those bits of buoyancy and interest and selfhood sort of disappear in drugs and attention and chaos. And that doesn't not feel like what might have happened.
I have to say, I really hated this movie pretty much beginning to end. I admire her performance just as you do, Julie. I think it's remarkable. But it doesn't allow us to see Marilyn Monroe as her creation, even a little bit. It's so about what's done to her, how objectified she is, sanctified, vilified, abandoned, Madonna whored. You know, I felt like I'd been cornered by the most pretentious person at the party, you know, who wanted to mansplain the male gaze to me. And I just kept wanting to wander off, like, impolitely. The point is exactly as Dana said it. It's there's something totally self-conscious and playful about those performances. It's the relationship between the real, confused, inchoate person and this, you know, icon, for lack of a better word, that makes those performances living today. And also, I can't get away, Dana, from the, like, I mean, for lack of a better word, there is just sort of a body porn element to this movie. I mean, people have been deeply offended by the depictions of sexual violence and abortion. They're just, I don't know. It's just hard for me to not perceive them as gratuitous and borderline sadistic.
Yeah, I think honestly, the movie was less graphic than I had thought from the, you know, the pre-release hype about its NC-17 rating and, you know, what it had done to deserve that. there's a lot of kind of waist up nudity, which I think is actually fairly true to life. Apparently, Marilyn Monroe loved to be naked and was almost always naked in her home domestic life. I think the most tasteless parts of the movie to me were those, as you describe it, like speculum cam abortions that we witness. And we haven't even gotten into the talking fetus, which is one of the most bizarre and tasteless parts of this movie, in referencing the fact that Monroe had several miscarriages and probably also had some abortions, maybe some of them foisted upon her by the studio during her life. We get to see have a couple of conversations between her and the fetus that she's carrying. And I mean, especially in the particular atmosphere of reproductive rights that we're in right now, they just ring so tasteless and so wrong. I don't know if they bothered you guys too, but yeah, we haven't really talked about how this movie looks and feels visually. And it's very, very, I guess the polite term would be inventive. Andrew Dominik has a big visual imagination, and he chops up scenes into strange fragments. He has all kinds of distorting CGI effects to suggest Marilyn Monroe's drunkenness or drug abuse. And I guess it looks cool, but all of that stuff to me also, Steve, went to the pretentious guy at a party cornering you, and it felt like showing off. I mean, any of that had come in the context of telling me more about this person besides their suffering, I might have been able to tolerate it. But
But did you guys not find any discordance between his? I mean, my attempt to mount a defense sort of collapsed in the face of your guys' smart points here. But did you not find some tension in the vivacity, the kind of juxtaposition of the life of Ana de Armas' performance and the intelligence of it, and then the dumbness of the movie around her? Like, I don't know, I found her so watchable.
Oh, completely agree. I mean, I probably say it better in what I wrote about the movie, because I was just fresh from seeing it then and had more detail in my mind. But it's a strange thing to admire a performance immensely while really disliking and even kind of being somewhat disgusted by the movie, it appears. And what it reminds me of in that way, and that tension that you describe between an excellent performance imprisoned in a bad script, is Joker, the movie Joker, which nobody could say that Joaquin Phoenix does not bring it all and have several beautiful moments like his dancing scenes. And yet that character makes no sense. So when I see Joker, I feel sorry, not for the character that we're supposed to feel sorry for, the Joker, but for the really wonderful actor who's trying so hard to bring something to such a confused mishmash of, exploitation and sentimentality and whatever else that movie is made of. And I think I feel something like that with this too.
Yeah. I mean, in a world where resources and funding to direct studio films and biopics were unlimited, and this was but one of many, many movies about Marilyn Monroe, it would feel better to be like, well, and then this one guy made a slightly pompous, slightly dumber than he thinks it was, a luxury art house woo-woo kaleidoscope about how weird it must have felt to be Marilyn Monroe. Like, in a world of infinite Marilyn movies, maybe that lands better than, like, of all the people to make a Marilyn movie, you could have Greta Gerwig's Marilyn movie. You could have Kathryn Bigelow's Marilyn movie. Like, you could have the Marilyn movie of someone who is much more curious about her art, her life, her mind, rather than her being kind of the object of so much attention and so much gaze. That's what makes it feel insulting. It's like, this is the guy that they gave for this movie? All right.
I think we have our last word there. All right. The movie is Blonde. It's streaming on Netflix. I think we're two emphatic thumbs down and one curiously equivocal thumb wavering between up and down. But anyway, check it out or not. But if you do, we'd love to hear from you. Let's move on.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on all your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval, terms apply.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
All right, well, Reboot is on Hulu. It's from the creator of Modern Family. It's a half-hour comedy, but it's about the making of a half-hour comedy on Hulu. That's only twist number one, though. The second one is the show is a reboot of an early aughts hit that was a super corny laugh track riot that is now being turned by its millennial showrunner into a dark look at family dysfunction, which sets up twist number three. The original show is created by her own highly dysfunctional and very absent father. The show stars Rachel Bloom as Hannah, Paul Reiser as her father, as well as Keegan-Michael Key and Johnny Knoxville and Judy Greer. In the clip we're about to hear, Paul Reiser wrangles with the cast of the show and with his estranged daughter, played by Bloom, who may or may not end up his creative partner. Let's listen.
Oh, hey, okay. Look at this little menagerie. What's happening here?
Gordon, obviously we were all thrown yesterday to find out that Hannah was your daughter, but, you know, family dynamics, they're so, I don't know, what's the word I'm looking for?
I don't know. Could you find it while I'm still young, please?
Gordon, we want her to stay for the good of the show.
Hey, just yesterday I asked her to stay, and she said, quote, I'd rather work at SeaWorld.
And then I had to explain to him why that's an insult.
Who doesn't love the Dolphin Spectacular?
The Dolphins.
All right, Julia, let me start with you. This show is nothing if not meta. That can sometimes work, sometimes fall flat on its face. Where did you come out on that with this show?
It's so interesting that Rachel Bloom is in the show because she is the very, very inventive, like almost too clever for primetime creator of Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, which is a very smart, ironical meta show. And so it's funny that she's in the show, but isn't the creator of the show. The creator of the show is Steve Levitan, the creator of Modern Family, and Just Shoot Me, and more classic kind of sitcom lineage type shows. And his sort of stand-in character is played by Paul Reiser. So you have this weird feeling that the concept of the show is actually a perfect concept for Rachel Bloom to have been the writer of, and yet Steve Levitan is the creator and showrunner of it, and she's merely acting. And as a result, there's like a tonal wobble as you watch it, because the whole point is that the show is trying to decide, you know, is it a classic, like, set up, laugh line, you know, corny multicam sitcom of yesteryear, or is it a arty, edgy, you know, single cam sitcom that's secretly just like a sad drama about how people are sad, where some of the lines make you wryly smile, the more current comedy trends. And the concept for the show is so good. And the cast is pretty great. Like, love to see Johnny Knoxville in an acting role. Oh my God, Judy Greer, she's sensational in this. Keegan-Michael Key always kind of makes me squirm, but I think that's his superpower, actually, and he's at his squirmiest here. And yet, it's like not as good as it should be. It's like, I kind of hope that it does get another season to work out its kinks, because I actually think the conceptual bones and the performances could gel into something tonally clearer and better than what is there. There's just a lot of kind of bozo jokes in this, and a lot of missed opportunities. That was my takeaway. What did you guys think?
Wow. You know, I knew when I was watching this that I was going to probably be the strongest defender of the show. And it may have to do with just how it landed with me on this particular week. I think I just really needed to like something and enjoy something in a simple way. And that was exactly how I felt about this show. I never watched Modern Family, so I don't know, or except maybe a couple times for us to talk about it for, you know, the first season for a segment here. So I don't really have a sense of the Steven Levitan universe that this is either, you know, coming from or subverting or whatever it's trying to do. So I can't really speak to the currents that are creating something like Reboot. All I can say is that this show made me laugh. I really enjoyed it. And I liked it enough that as I was watching to prep for this segment, there were only four segments that had dropped. But last night at midnight, I knew another one was coming. And I stayed up until midnight to watch the last half hour I could possibly watch to bring it to our conversation, just because I wanted to keep on seeing what was happening. So yes, this show hits conventional sitcom beats in its construction. But that was actually kind of a relief to me. I feel like we watch so many streaming shows, streaming comedies that have this kind of raggedy, uneven quality, like, oh, I don't know if this episode is going to be 20 minutes long or 40 minutes long because the segments are all different in this show. And, oh, it takes 10 episodes to actually figure out the deep mythology of the Me Too allegory or something. Like, this show has none of that. Everything is right there in the text and it is tightly constructed. It's always half an hour long, which I appreciate. And it usually has about three plots going at once that interweave fairly successfully. All the performances, I agree, Julia, are really excellent. We haven't talked about the kid, who I think is one of the funniest characters on the show. So the sitcom they're rebooting had a child in the original version. And now 15 years later, he's this 20-something kid who's sort of an aging child actor who hasn't fully grown up yet. And Calum Worthy playing this kid, Zach, is just hilarious. And slowly, as the season goes on, becomes a deeper and deeper character. At the beginning, he's sort of a pain in the ass, you know, that the adult actors just want to get rid of. And then his stories start to take on more of an arc and he gets really interesting. And I now actually love this show and I want to watch it all the way through till the end. But I kind of feel about it in a way that's hard to defend on the Culture Fest. It's not that it's breaking any new ground necessarily. I just feel like now it's one of my shows and it's a comfort watch and I'm going to keep on going.
Dana, if you like this show, you should go back and watch Modern Family, which is actually like an excellent version of a classic sitcom. Like if you like Stephen Levitan's vibe, you should go watch Modern Family, where it actually is in its like highest and best form.
Yeah, I guess I should. I mean, it seems like part of what this show is about is the tension between a show like that, that's a network show for a broader audience, and something like this, that's a streaming show, right? And we haven't really talked about it, but this show's on Hulu, and there's also some sort of mockery of Hulu within it, because the show within it is being shot on Hulu. I don't know. I mean, this show has everything to be one of the kind of insufferable, self-regarding show business comedies that we get sick of talking about, I think. And, you know, we've often mentioned before that people in Hollywood can't think of stories about anything except Hollywood. But because it has a sweetness to it and a lightheartedness, and I think is not ultimately mean toward its characters, I had a lot more patience for this show. Also, we haven't really talked about her much because she never gets talked about as much as she deserves. But Judy Greer finally getting a role where she actually gets to do something besides be the supportive best friend of the rom-com heroine is just brilliant. And I was looking at Judy Greer's bio on Wiki just to remember things I'd seen her in the past and how often I've wished that she had a bigger part. And that seems to run through all of Judy Greer criticism. Like as you look at her Wiki entry and the reception of her various projects, person after person, including me, I'm quoted in her Wiki page, but all these critics keep on saying, underutilized, doesn't get enough to do. Judy Greer, team player, always great. Wish she had a bigger role. This comes up over and over and over again throughout her career. So for her to get this big role of this, you know, hilarious, I mean, she reminds me a little bit of the Lisa Kudrow character in that, you know, what was that fake reality show?
The Comeback.
The Comeback. Yes, exactly. It's a little bit that sort of character, right? Like someone who's really vain and worried about aging and very self-regarding, but ultimately also sort of a ditzy delight. And so any moment she's on screen is a good moment. Yeah, I'm sorry. I like Reboot. Sue me.
Steve, break the tie.
Team Dana. I took no notes. I have nothing to say other than this show cracked me the fuck.
Yes.
Up.
High five and you virtually, Steve.
Everything about it was designed to make me hate it. And everything about its execution made me love it. All the critical bones in my body are inert right now. I cannot separate myself from my own love for it right from the beginning. Riser's terrific in it. Judy Greer is a revelation. She's so funny in it. She's so absolutely pitch perfect. I'm a avowed enemy of Cake and Eat It Too productions that say, we'll do this same shitty formulaic, overfamiliar thing, but we'll do it with this layer of postmodern irony and therefore get away with it all over again and satisfy every living person on the planet and back up the Brinks truck and whatever. I hate that. I hate Hollywood cannibalizing itself with satire. It's like, get out of your world. Like, go fucking turn your gaze on something else. Like, I just don't need to see. I don't need to be inside another writer's room on another lot. I just didn't care. I was like, I just want these jokes. I laughed repeatedly into my noise cancellation headphones at like 5 a.m. this morning. And I want to be around these people. I think they're hilariously funny.
Are you serious? You guys are going to defend those excruciating writer's room scenes where the alter cocker, you know, white people from the writer's rooms of the 80s are like, fart joke. And then the, you know, woke writers hired for the streaming show are like, no, make fun of indigenous people. Like, come on. Those scenes sucked. Really?
But Fred Melamed is in them, and Fred Melamed is never not funny.
That's true. That Fred Melamed kind of saves it. And oh, and then Rachel Bloom quits and she trips on a trash can and they're all united by the you know, common love of slapstick. And somehow the person who tripped on the trash can isn't Johnny Knoxville. Like, come on. It's good. It has good bones, but it's not there yet. It's not like an unmitigated success.
Listen, Homer nods. I mean, woe unto the person who sees only the blemish and not the beautiful face. I mean, it's not perfect, but it's like good-willed and kind of raffish. And it's not, in my perception, in the least bit self-regarding. Plus, I don't know what Paul Reiser's been doing since Mad About You. A ton of things, no doubt. But going back to Diner, when I first encountered him, literally in 1981, I have loved Reiser. This is a perfect, I mean, I don't want to say resurrection. It's way too condescending. The man works all the time. He's a fucking legend. But he's just, it's terrific to see him in this role. It suits where he is in his career and life. And I feel like he's just bringing that same set of chops to it. I love the way we've all regressed to our sort of pre-critical cortex or something. Like, we're all sort of loving and hating it without using elevated language. But it doesn't demand overthinking, right? It's like, Dana, I agree. There's like, we're only, I mean, most of us, I think, we're only, I mean, we're living normally, but emotionally, we're only halfway out of COVID. And fully in, like, under the COVID delusion, the lockdown delusion, we all thought Ted Lasso was a good TV show. And halfway out of it, we think this is a good TV show. And maybe all the way out of it, we'll be back to, you know, Dostoevsky and Chekhov. But as of right now, this feels, it hits some spot that sorely needs hitting.
This show felt somehow medically necessary to me. And as I said earlier, it does hit conventional beats. I'm not defending it on the grounds of it being a groundbreaking piece of art. But as I think I've made clear in many discussions about TV, I really appreciate TV shows, especially half-hour sitcoms, that feel episodic and tightly scripted and as if they have a beginning, middle, and end and know what they set out to accomplish and accomplish it. And this show, to me, does that. And right now, that's enough.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Hey, listeners, whether you love true crime or comedies, celebrity interviews, news, or even motivational speakers, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue, right? And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance, too. Enter the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. The Name Your Price tool puts you in charge of your auto insurance by working just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance. Then they'll show you a variety of coverages that fit within your budget, giving you options. Now, that's something you'll want to press play on. It's easy to start a quote, and you'll be able to choose the best option for you fast. It's just one of the many ways you can save with Progressive Insurance. Quote today at progressive.com to try the Name Your Price tool for yourself and join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
All right. Well, Loretta Lynn died last week at the age of 90. She is, I mean, it goes without saying, an icon of country music. Tough, no-nonsense woman whose attitude and career cut hard against the grain of Nashville in the 60s and well beyond. She said, "I wasn't the first woman in country music. I was just the first one to stand up there and say what I thought, what life was about. The rest were afraid to." And she also said, "I didn't write for men. I wrote for women." That's a big subject of Carl Wilson's remembrance of her on Slate. Of course, Carl is Slate's music critic. Carl, welcome back.
So good to be here and to be talking about Loretta.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I guess it's probably fair to say that her, I don't know, most familiar song is Coal Miner's Daughter, made that much more familiar by the extraordinary biopic starring Sissy Spacek that came out, I think, in 1980, a great movie in its own right. But she was the product of a very specific time and place and upbringing. Why don't we start there and then move on to the bulk of your piece, which is wonderfully about her complicated feminism. But talk about her, what turned her into Loretta Lynn.
Yeah, I mean, so as the song and the movie Coal Miner's Daughter really lay out very clearly and unforgettably, Loretta was born in Butcher's Hollow, Kentucky, a coal mining community, in a large family of, I think, six or seven siblings. And then she got married at the age of 15 to Oliver Lynn, who was known locally as Doolittle because he didn't want to be a coal miner, and also as Mooney because he, one of the things he did instead of coal mining was make moonshine. And they moved out to Washington State a couple of years later. Over the course of up between that marriage and when she turned 20, she had her first four children. She had twins a few years later, making six altogether. But one of the things that happened was her husband overheard her singing and thought she was really good and bought her a guitar in the 50s. And she taught herself to play and taught herself to write songs as well, which was a unusual thing for any country artist to do for themselves in that era, and particularly for a woman to do. And she started gigging around at clubs and eventually got picked up by a record label. And basically by the early 60s, she was putting songs on the country charts, but her big breakthrough kind of came in the mid 60s when she really started singing those kind of outspoken songs about the sort of battle of the sexes that became her signatures. And so she started first having her first country number ones around then and proceeded along those lines into the early 70s when also her several records of duets with Conway Twitty became mainstream country hits. So eventually, by sort of the early 70s, she was really the queen of country music at the time. She was the first woman in country to be given the CMA's, the Country Music Association's biggest award, Entertainer of the Year. And at the end of the 70s, she was given an Entertainer of the Decade prize. And she really sort of defined country music in that time in a lot of ways, alongside people like Dolly Parton and Tammy Wynette, and, you know, on the women's side, and people like George Jones and Conway on the men's side. And really, there's no country singer, especially women country singers, and lots of women outside of country for whom she's not a definitive influence.
Carl, let's go back to the 60s and maybe pick one of the early songs that showed her emergence, you know, something a little less familiar. You have a tune you want to play?
Well, I was going to suggest that we listen to her first country number one, which is from 1966, Don't Come Home and Drinkin' with Lovin' on Your Mind, which is really an indicator of both her sense of humor and that kind of battle of the sexes theme. And, you know, the humorousness of the song with this really kind of dark undertone about a husband coming home sozzled and trying to force himself on his wife. That's kind of a balance of forces that she kept going.
Well, you thought I'd be waiting up when you came home last night. You'd been out with all the boys and you ended up half tied. But liquor and love, they just don't mix. Leave the bottle or me behind.
Carl, I guess maybe this is a good way, that clip is a good in to talk about kind of the approach that you took in your tribute to Loretta Lynn on Slate, which was to kind of take on her, I don't know what you would call it, her ambivalent, confrontational style of feminism. I don't know if you could quite call her a feminist. I don't think she would have wanted to call herself one, as most female country singers don't. But there's no question that throughout her career, there was a tone not unlike the one we hear in that last song, right? I mean, she wrote about troubled marriages from the point of view of the put upon woman. She wrote about female rivals, right, in songs like Fist City or You're Not Woman Enough to Take My Man, in this also kind of confrontational aggro way, but humorously so. And she also, as you talk about, wrote about, you know, birth control and the pill and what would have been called women's lib at the time, in a way that was unusual, but that is also hard for us now as 21st century, you know, talking from a feminist point of view, as 21st century feminists to incorporate and to metabolize. So there's a lot going on with Loretta Lynn's attitude toward being a woman in the world. And I wondered if you could talk about that.
Yeah. I mean, she really, really did break an enormous amount of ground in terms of both singing about topical public interest issues in ways that were really kind of out of bounds in the country industry at the time, but also the specific sense of writing from a woman's point of view for women, not sort of playing the character of a dutiful or shrinking damsel or you know, even the faithful wife, although she was that. But she certainly flirted with the idea that one didn't necessarily have to feel confined by domestic duty entirely. You know, she wrote the song in the early 70s, Rated X, which is about divorce and about the stigma attached to divorced women, the supposition that they were floozies that was still in the culture at the time. And about birth control with the pill, which she recorded in 1972. It wasn't an original song of hers, but she cut it in 1972, and the record company held it back until 1975, still feeling that it might be too edgy for the country market. And when it came out in 1975, it was banned by all kinds of country radio stations that refused to play it. But at the same time, yeah, she did not have a completely sympathetic relationship with the women's liberation movement that was coming out of, you know, the big cities on the coast. And that, I think, like, you know, definitely it is true that's partly for marketing reasons and not to want to tie yourself too much to a controversial political movement. But I think she also had genuine differences and a sense of alienation from the tone of the movement. You know, as a woman who never went to high school and had four children in her teens, and in a lot of ways didn't feel like the kind of white middle class to upper middle class educated feminist movement in its way of presenting itself really spoke to her and her experience. But, you know, in a lot of ways, she dealt with all the same kinds of themes that were driving that movement in terms of, you know, equal rights, equal pay, working women, the question of power balances in marriage and of the burdens of motherhood. That was all there from early on in her work. And she really had a kind of crackling voice that brooked no wishy-washiness about what she was saying.
Can we listen a little bit to The Pill?
You whine me and dine me when I was your girl. Promised if I'd be your wife, you'd show me the world. But all I've seen of this old world is a bed and a doctor bill. I'm tearing down your brooder house, 'cause now I've got the pill. All these years.
The other thing that really strikes me going back and listening to her songs this weekend is there's almost like a Trojan horse quality to the way her politics is embedded in her songs, in that, and I mean that as a compliment, in that she's using what I think of as the key tools of country songwriting, which is humor and storytelling. And the songs are absolutely grounded in specific details and eliciting a wry smile when you get to the chorus. And then embedded within that is like No, you can't actually have sex with your wife whenever you want. Sometimes she doesn't want to have sex with you, or she actually does not want to stay home and have unlimited children forever. And reproductive freedom is important to her. Like, and there's a way in which the kind of will she call herself a feminist question feels almost like it misses the point, in that she's finding ways that are so clever and smart and just delicious to listen to use classic elements of the genre to advance modern ideas about gender.
Yeah, I mean, one, there are so many levels on which the pill operates in that way. One of the things I love is that, especially in the first half of the song, she continually compares herself to a chicken and who has to lay eggs all the time. And, you know, one of the sort of like very punk rock, but very country lines in it is I'm tearing down this brooder house. You know, I think it's very deliberate that it's that country about its way of talking about this very modern subject. And then in the sort of wind up to the song, it really strongly presents the appeal to the husband, in the sense that, you know, once I'm not pregnant and having children all the time, I'll want to dress up and go out and have sex with you, all of those things. And it's certainly celebrating her own pleasure in doing those things, but it's definitely trying to say to the husband, like, this is not a loss for you, this is a gain for you. And so it is very strategic and clever on all those levels.
Carl, there's so many places we could go with such a long career, but something that really struck me in reading about Loretta Lynn is that, talk about making music until the end, she recorded an album, as you mentioned, when she was 89 years old last year in 2021. And that was just so incredible to me that I was hoping maybe we could go out on hearing a cut from that album. Do you have an idea of what we could listen to?
Yeah, that album, incidentally, was produced by her daughter, Patsy, obviously named after Patsy Cline, and with John Carter Cash, the son of Johnny Cash. So there's this real cross-generational energy there. And the title track, Still Woman Enough, is a duet with Reba McEntire and Carrie Underwood. So then that's a way to bring things full circle.
Well, I've been through some bad times, been on the bottom, been at the top, and I've seen life from both sides. It's what you make with what you've got. There's been times life's got me down, pick myself up and bounce right back around. I wasn't raised to give up, and to this day, you know what, I'm still woman enough, still got what it takes inside.
All right. Well, Carl, thanks so much for coming on to talk about Loretta Lynn. What an incredible career and woman and set of songs. Thanks for coming back. Come back soon.
Always.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights. Gay rights now! Gay rights! With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queen say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.
All right, let's endorse. Dana Stevens, what do you have?
Well, as long as we're talking about Judy Greer, I have a perfect segue to my endorsement, which is that I'm endorsing a movie with Judy Greer. I'm getting a chance to do all the great things she can do. And in fact, it is thematically related to Reboot in that it's a movie about TV. This is a movie called The TV Set from 2007, I believe it was. I remember that I had just started writing on movies pretty recently for Slate, and I remember reviewing it and absolutely loving it. So I went back and reread my review because I vaguely remembered, wasn't Judy Greer in a great movie way back, you know, a decade and a half ago? The TV Set is this really, it's actually quite different from Reboot in that it's not a satire. It's a dramatic film about the making of a TV show. And without spoiling too much about the movie, it's sort of about the compromises that have to be made in order to keep a broadcast sitcom on the air. Sigourney Weaver is also in it as this wonderfully soulless TV executive who keeps trying to dumb down the show. And David Duchovny is the TV writer who's trying to keep the show quality. And it's just, it's a really, really nice, fairly serious, but also sort of tragicomic story about artistic compromise. Judy Greer gets a rare chance, as she does again in Reboot now, to do all the things that she can do so well and play drama and comedy both at once. And just the other day, I saw Emily Nussbaum, former TV critic at The New Yorker, who writes wonderfully on television, putting out a question, what is a great movie about TV? And my recommendation and the recommendation of some other people in the thread was, watch The TV Set. It's directed by Jake Kasdan. It's from 2007, and it's out there streaming if you want to try to find it.
That is very cool. I did not know that show existed. Julia, what do you have?
I would like to recommend a cookbook called Snacking Cakes by Yossi Areffi. That's Snacking Cakes, Simple Treats for Anytime Cravings, a baking book, a double subhead, double subtitle. You gotta love it. The complication of the subtitle is at odds with the conceit of the book, which is that sometimes you want to just dump a bunch of stuff in one bowl, stir it up, throw it in a pan and stick it in the oven and make something tasty in like 45 minutes. And you don't want multiple steps and you don't want to, you know, be piping things or doing anything too complicated. And this is just a great, slender little cookbook full of, you know, quickie half an afternoon baking projects. I made a zesty zucchini seed cake this weekend that was lemon zest, zucchini, cinnamon, and then you just like dump all the seeds you have at your house in it. So I did flax and chia and poppy and some slivered almonds, and it's yummy and crunchy, and never would have thought to make it without this delicious little cookbook, Snacking Cakes by Yossi Areffi. So check it out.
I love your food recommendations. I'm scribbling that down right now.
That sounds very cool. Okay. I want to endorse, how to even put it? I'm not really endorsing a specific thing, but I want to note that the, I think, truly great philosopher Bruno Latour has died. Here's a quote that I think, I can't remember whether it was Guardian or Le Monde or someone quoted Latour as having once said, "Facts remain robust only when they are supported by a common culture, by institutions that can be trusted, by a more or less decent public life, by more or less reliable media." And so I guess what I'm endorsing is anyone listening, if they're so inclined, becoming interested in the life and work of Latour, if they aren't already. There's so many good books. You could email me if you wanted to, and I could tell you which ones I liked and why. But what I would also say is just throw the lie back into someone's face if they dare tell it to you, that somehow the post-truth culture that's a creation of right-wing ethno-nationalist morons somehow originated in like French philosophy or postmodern theory or literary theory or the academy or something like that. That's complete and utter nonsense. That sentiment, as voiced by Latour, is the absolute opposite of everything the post-truth culture is and has become. So anyway, in memoriam, Bruno Latour, I believe a truly astonishing thinker. Julia, thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve.
And Dana, of course, as always, a pleasure. Thanks.
It was a joy.
You will find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page. That's slate.com slate.com/culturefest, and you can email us at culturefest@slate.com. Our introductory music is by the composer Nicholas Bertel. Our producer is Yanni Evans. Our production assistant is Nadira Goff. For Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, I'm Stephen Metcalf. Thank you so much for joining us. We will see you soon.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queen say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.